Hello and welcome to Reading McCarthy. Reading McCarthy is a podcast devoted to the consideration and discussion of the works of one of our greatest American writers, Cormac McCarthy. Each episode will call upon different well-known Cormacian readers, scholars, other experts to help us explore different works and various essential aspects of McCarthy's writing. My name is Scott Yarbrough, and I'll be your host for these forays into the deep wilds, dark roads, back alleys, and badlands of Cormac McCarthy. As always, listeners are warned there'll be spoilers here. Our guest today returns, and we're glad to have him back, and it's Rick Wallach. Rick is one of the founders of the Cormac McCarthy Society, recently retired after some number of years teaching English at the University of Miami. Senior editor of the Cormac McCarthy Society casebook series and editor of the two-volume collection of essays, Sacred Violence, as well as Myth, Legend, Dust, Critical Responses to Cormac McCarthy, and co-editor with Linnea Chapman King and the late James Welsh of From Novel to Film, No Country for Old Men. He has written widely and extensively on numerous topics, literature, film, media, and contemporary music, and is currently working on a book called In Search of Godzilla, Myth, History, and Politics in Ishiro Honda's Masterpiece. So at some point, we'll have to figure out exactly how McCarthy and Godzilla meet up, Rick, and I'm thinking Shiger might be the answer to that. Well, I don't know if he'd flip the coin for the great beast.
Well, Godzilla was there first.
Godzilla was there first.
Yeah,
or was Shiger always there, and we just didn't know it?
Yeah.
For people who know me well, they've heard this story many times, and people who've listened to the podcast pretty seriously have heard this before, but it bears repeating, I think. After the Border Trilogy completed, we had several years with no hint of what McCarthy was doing. Everyone assumed that the next book was going to be The Passenger, because that's what he'd been working on before the Border Trilogy and during the Border Trilogy. It's what we all were talking about all the time. We assumed there was a New Orleans book called The Passenger coming out. And then, bang, 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 right in a row, in 2 years, we had No Country for Old Men, then The Road, and then The Sunset Limited, the play that was printed and later filmed for HBO by Tommy Lee Jones. Now, right after the novel came out, I put together a panel at the South Atlantic Modern Language Association that I believe was held in Atlanta that year. And I had a crackerjack group of people on that panel to discuss this new McCarthy novel. Chip Arnold, the kind of original godfather of all McCarthy studies, yourself, one of the other OG original gangsters, as I call it, Farrell O'Gorman, who does an awful lot with Irish lit, Roman Catholic literature, and Southern literature, and who'd done some really excellent work on McCarthy at that point, and myself. It was given to us during the dinner hour Saturday night, and only one person appeared. Now, it does happen that you weren't able to make it because of a hurricane coming on your home, and you made the, as I've always put it, selfish decision to protect home and family over coming to the panel. And I guess I'll forgive you for that for one day, Rick.
Takes a lot of time to put those damn shutters up, you know.
Yeah, that it does. As I grew up in Florida as well, and I know of whence you speak. But the thing is, no one at SAMLA knew you weren't going to be there. And I mean, this should have looked like an amazing panel, but it shows you people were not really paying that much attention to McCarthy yet, or that invested in McCarthy. And I really think it comes down to Before the Road and After the Road. You know, the other big landmark we always talk about is All the Pretty Horses. And then the other one is The Road, it seems, for making that change. I mean, with Bert Hitchcock, former president of SAMLA, actually, he was not president of SAMLA yet at this point, as I recall, but former chair of English at Auburn University, Bert Hitchcock was the only person who came to the panel, and we just kind of sat around and read each other's papers and talked a good bit and had a good bit of fun. But it's amazing to me how much this novel has grown in people's imagination since the Coen brothers turned in their pretty masterful film work of it, and how much the novel has grown in terms of the McCarthy canon. Now, if you go onto the various web pages that are dedicated to people or social media groups that are dedicated to people who like McCarthy's work, this novel is always in the consideration for the among the top favorites. And I don't think that was true for most Cormacians around 2006 or so. And it wasn't true for you originally, but that's changed, right?
Oh, very much so. I think, by the way, that part of that lack of interest, although I don't think that's really what it was, but part of the quiet reception from our point of view, academic reception, is that there had been, I think, something like an 11-year hiatus there between Cities of the Plain, which itself was a kind of a low-energy book in most people's estimation. Then you get that long stretch of nothing.
Yeah.
And then No Country comes out. And I think people just were looking for something else to do besides McCarthy because of that long interregnum. So I don't think it had that much to do with the quality of the book. Although, yeah, you're right. I mean, when it first came out, and I had an advanced reading copy, so I had a jump on it, about a 4 or 5 month jump on it. I was not enormously thrilled the first time through it.
Right.
It looked to me, I mean, Chigurh looked to me like Judge Holden Light, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though I liked Cities of the Plain, I think, a lot more than a lot of other people did, I was on some other tracks. I was distracted by David Mitchell, you know, by Cloud Atlas and Thousand Autumns. And I had other things to do. But yes, the novel has definitely grown. The film had less to do with that in my case than simply a rereading of it.
Well, certainly McCarthy scholars and serious McCarthy readers, I don't think were turned onto the novel by the film. They had read the book anyway.
Yeah.
But I do think the wider audience, and just as a point of correction, I think it was 7 years. Cities of the Plain is 98, and then No Country for Old Men is 2005. So 7 or 8 years there between them. But I think really where I'm coming from is more, here we are at a literary conference, and McCarthy, I think you could argue, even before his work in the first decade of the 21st century, was one of the handful of the most important novelists of American literature of the 20th century. And the critical zeitgeist had just not quite caught up. And I do in some ways still feel like the film adaptation spread the word so much, combined with Pulitzer Prize winning The Road, is what brought more people around. And I think the other thing you said is totally correct, which is, for a lot of us, it's going back to No Country for Old Men that really made it grow in our estimation, as opposed to how we saw it the first time.
Yeah.
Why don't we briefly describe, and as always, listeners reminded, there are spoilers here, but why don't we briefly describe just what happens in the novel No Country for Old Men? We have a welder and Vietnam vet named Llewellyn Moss. As I recall, we're given some indication of the year of the novel setting. Could you walk us through that briefly?
Yeah. During the coin flip scene at the gas station, Chigurh tells the clerk that this is a 1958 quarter, and he said it's been traveling for 22 years, and now it's here. That sets it up as 1980 pretty succinctly. Yeah.
Well, and it's important because we have Llewellyn Moss as a Vietnam vet, and in 1980, then his 30-something age is appropriate. If it's set much later, making him a Vietnam vet doesn't work. If it's set much earlier, it kind of changes things. But it also means that Llewellyn Moss can be connected to a World War II veteran, such as Sheriff Bell.
Yeah.
And that's one of the elements that the film version doesn't go into at all, and I think it's to the film's detriment, that they forget to talk about Ed Tom Bell as a World War II vet. And so Llewellyn stumbles upon, while he's out hunting in the hills of West Texas, he stumbles upon what seems to have been a drug deal, a massive, serious drug transaction gone wrong. This is not a handshake deal on a downtown street somewhere between two guys, you know, one guy scoring and the other guy getting $50 for it. This is a huge transport of heroin and a huge payoff for that. And at some point they pull for guns, they get into a big gunfight. Everyone is mostly dead except for one guy who stirs and asks for water. Llewellyn backtracks, another guy finds the money that had been carried away, realizes it's a significant amount of change, and makes a decision right there that's going to haunt him the rest of the novel, because instead of fleeing and contacting authorities or just fleeing, he decides to take the money. And in the middle of the night, the other decision he makes, although we later know this wouldn't have made any difference in the long run, the other decision he makes is to go back in the middle of the night and take the guy some water because he feels guilty having left the man dying without anything to drink. And soon, Anton Chigurh comes into it and is on the trail of the money and of Llewellyn Moss, and leaves a path to destruction while Bell tries to, who figures out what's going on, tries to somehow intercede between them and save Llewellyn while stopping Chigurh from his murder spree across Texas. And it's interesting to say he's on a spree because that makes you think of earlier films, earlier novels about, I don't know, methamphetamine-crazed people in their early 20s who were just on this kind of rambunctious ride where they just murder people at will. And Chigurh is much more controlled and tightly wound than that. But at the same time, he has zero moral compass. Everything to him is more that, I don't know, would you say he sees himself as a kind of the hand of fate, and others are simply denying themselves when they try to get in his way, as governed by that coin flip? Or how do you see Chigurh? I mean, we'll come back to him in more detail later.
Well, I think that he is a psychopathic killer.
Well, indisputably.
Yeah.
Or at least sociopathic, right?
But yeah, sociopathic at the very least. And there is method to his madness. I mean, he's cobbled together a very intricate philosophy about himself and about his work and about his goals.
Right.
And, you know, he says at some point, he says, I have no other way to live.
Right.
You know, I have these rules and I live by them and I have no other way to live. Every time he opens his mouth, you get another disquisition on his rules.
Right.
So he's a pretty complicated character. But toward the end of the novel, and we'll get to this later in more detail, he does something. And again, this is something else that's missing from the film. He does something that reveals that he's got a plan, you know. Right. He's got a goal, he's got a plan, and it's more, it transcends getting the money back and bringing it back to the cartel.
Right.
It has to do with his own ambitions, and he is definitely an ambitious character.
Yeah, and he, for that matter, he betrays the cartels and the original people who hire him. He shoots down the whoever it is, whatever representative it is that hires him. He kills those two guys. He goes on and moves and makes the deal later with some of the higher ups because of those ambitions, as like, well, just like you were saying.
Yeah, he's serving the oil company.
Right.
The two guys he kills are representatives of his boss at the oil company.
Right.
And so there are two masters here: the oil company, the people with the money, and then there's the cartel, the people with the heroin. So, you know, he makes a choice. He's serving himself, actually.
Right.
You know, and that becomes clear toward the end of the film when he brings the money back.
Well, towards the end of the book, because yeah, the film doesn't show that scene, right?
Well, we don't see this in the film. All we know in the film is that he got the money back.
Right.
Okay. And then he's got his, quote, promise, unquote, to Moss to kill his wife.
Right.
And again, because of this system of rules he lives by, even though Moss is already dead, he feels obligated to Moss to keep his promise.
Right.
And, you know, in that, he reminds me curiously of Angel Eyes from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Ah.
You know, when he murders that hacendado at the beginning of the film and says, look, I have a contract here to kill you, and I have to keep it. So he's ethical after his fashion.
After his very oddly defined, very narrowly strictured fashion, we might say.
Which, by the way, also reminds me quite a bit of the Johnny Casper character in Miller's Crossing.
Right.
Which is a film that Cormac McCarthy very much admired himself.
Yes.
And, you know, at the very beginning of the movie, he's talking to the Irish mobster.
Right. Tom Reagan.
Yeah. Well, Tom Reagan and what's his name?
Leo from Albert Finney's character, Leo.
Albert Finney says, I'm talking about friendship. I'm talking about character. I ain't ashamed to use the word. I'm talking about ethics.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And the whole novel, that whole film, it's interesting. You and I bonded over our mutual love of Miller's Crossing. And I don't think at that point the interview with McCarthy had come out that talked about his own love for that film.
No, that was in the Village Voice interview that he did with the Coen brothers.
Right.
And he says, oh, I love that film. And Ethan Coen, I think, says, oh, that's just a ripoff of The Glass Key. And McCarthy says, oh, yeah, but it's a great ripoff. You know?
Right. He says, and everything's a ripoff, he also says, if I remember right. Well, and you and I said at that time, if anyone is ever to do adaptations of McCarthy, it probably needs to be the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And that was that discussion, if I recall, was in 2003 or 2004, somewhere in that time period. And so.
And then we find out that they're doing No Country.
Years later, they're doing No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And it's funny you say that, because I do, in some ways, think of Chigurh and his code. Is that something that always defines Dashiell Hammett's characters, although they're usually on the other side of the coin, so to say. But the Continental Op often doesn't care who's right and who's wrong. He just knows who he's paid to go after. And so he honors his own rules. And, of course, the movie Miller's Crossing is a blending together of The Glass Key with a lot of Red Harvest thrown in there. And if you like Dashiell Hammett, you have to rush out and watch Miller's Crossing. And if you love Miller's Crossing, you have to rush out and read Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah.
And I do think Chigurh, there is a connection there. And that, well, let's maybe before we look at the other characters that are in the book and kind of break it down that way, why don't we talk about the origins of this novel? It started like Cities of the Plain as a screenplay. But the difference is, if you were to plot out the screenplay for the film Cities of the Plain and the novel Cities of the Plain and took the writing out of it and simply focused on what happened, Cities of the Plain's outline is pretty similar in both versions.
Yeah.
The more macro you get, the more of a long view you take, it's almost the same. Whereas the outline for the film version for No Country for Old Men, which I have not read the screenplay, but I was going back to Stacey Peebles' book, Cormac McCarthy and Performance, Page, Stage, and Screen. And she has a chapter in there on unproduced screenplays. And so I went back and looked at her description of it. And boy, it has almost nothing to do other than character names, and only a couple of the character names, with the actual novel. So instead of Chigurh, we have a kind of typical, completely amoral villain named Ralston, who has a flunky named Milo. And then Ed Tom and Llewellyn form kind of an older cop, younger guy, buddy cop movie. Llewellyn's not a cop, but they team up, they take care of the bad guys, and they do what needs to be done. And so it's much more conventional, much more, I don't know, this was a thing going on in the 80s. You know, it's the time of all the Lethal Weapon movies and the Beverly Hills Cop movies. Now, with that stated, I cannot imagine anything McCarthy ever had anything to do could ever in any way intersect with Beverly Hills Cop 1 or 2. I don't know if there was a third. I don't think so.
Well, the Coen brothers, of course, wrote their own screenplay.
Right.
They didn't use that.
Well, because that screenplay has very little to do with the novel they're adapting, other than the basic notion that, you know, Llewellyn finds money, the cartels are involved, hitmen are involved, Ed Tom Bell gets wrapped into it. So that's the same, and everything else is different. Loretta is not around in the novel. I don't think Carla Jean, or in the screenplay, excuse me. Loretta's not in the screenplay. I don't think Carla Jean is in the screenplay. And instead, Ed Tom lives with a granddaughter he's raising because his daughter has died, and his granddaughter's messing around with the guy that's no good. And Ed Tom knows he's no good because he's riding a motorcycle. And just the whole notion of who these characters are.
Well, the motorcycle riding no good Nick comes back in the next drug movie, The Counselor.
The Counselor, right? We have a little bit
of that. He rides through the wire and gets decapitated.
Right. The old French Maquis trick for getting rid of the Gestapo trail riders.
Yeah, the Green Hornet.
and Green Hornet approach.
Right? Yeah, so I think Ed Tom gets his revenge, you know, parabolically
in that way.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I think is interesting to think about is what he does with that screenplay is he writes a typical noir crime action film. There's very little in it that says this is the kind of thing McCarthy would do that any of these number of other writers or directors wouldn't do. But with the actual novel, when he sat down to write it, even though the language was such a seismic shift from what he had done before, and it's so Spartan compared to earlier writing. And you see parts of this in what he's doing with Cities of the Plain, that not including Billy's section at the end, but the first two thirds of Cities of the Plain. It's definitely not written at the level of kind of poetic high lyricism of All the Pretty Horses or the very dense philosophical prose of The Crossing. We definitely see Cities of the Plain before you get to the last chunk with Billy is a little more Spartan, a little more sparse, but now No Country for Old Men moves much further in that direction. And this is a novel where people start really thinking about and talking about Hemingway's influence on McCarthy. And if you know where to look and what you're looking for and how to find it, it's all through McCarthy, especially after starting in Blood Meridian and on, if not so much the earlier books. But this novel, particularly stylistically, is a big shift away. And then he subverts all the conventions of the typical thriller, right?
Yeah. Well, what happens, I think, is that he became much more involved with Ed Tom.
Right.
You know, I think that the efflorescence of Ed Tom's character as a guilt-ridden, doubt-ridden man who wants to believe very badly in the good in people,
right,
and is simply losing his grip on that belief,
right,
through the course of the novel, is what transforms that original screenplay into a very fine work of art.
Right.
And it was my locking on to the processes in Ed Tom's character that changed my opinion of the novel.
Ah.
But, or at least that was the first thing that changed my opinion of the novel.
Right.
I thought that the way McCarthy handled that was very deft and quite brilliant. And I also loved the way I began to realize how the novel tracked Sailing to Byzantium.
Yeah.
You know, the poem, especially with that, you know, that 2-ton rough-hewn stone water trough. Standing in for the finely filigreed golden bird, you know, at the end of the poem, which I thought was very, very ironic and very clever and very amusing. Also, there's a kind of a black comedy in it that I really appreciated. The more that I reread the novel and the more these other correspondences I found in it, the more I appreciated it. One of the other things that I very much appreciated were the parallels between Shiger and Judge Holden from Blood Meridian.
Right.
Not the least of which is the way that Judge Holden's demonic plan for the Glanton gang in general is inflected in the way that Shiger turns on his cartel and oil company employers and affiliates. Mm. You know, Blood Meridian is a systematic process of Holden destroying the Glanton gang.
Right.
Leading them from one disaster till the next, you know, until there's nothing left of them. And Shiger is effectively doing the same thing. And when at the end of the No Country, he returns the money to the cartel boss, you can already see the process of betrayal coming full circle.
Right.
And what he says, here's your money back. The people you listen to, were the wrong people. They right. brought you to this, and if not for me, you wouldn't have this back. And I'll be back. I have something to do, which is go kill Carla Jean.
Right.
But I'll be back, and then we'll talk about where we're going as a business. And you already know that where they're going as a business is, I'm going to situate myself as your primary advisor. And ultimately, I'm going to kill you off and take over your whole cartel. You know, you can see that happening. You can project that that's what's going to happen. And I thought that, too, was, you know, that's the unstated end, you know, the unstated climax. And I thought that, too, was quite brilliant. By leaving that scene out of the movie, I think the Coen brothers missed out on an opportunity. But I also appreciate what they were trying to do to streamline the movie and make it a you know, watchable movie.
Yeah, every film adaptation really has to be taken simply at its own value, whether it's a good movie or not, and not necessarily how faithful it is to the novel or not. And my own rubric is always, is it faithful to the spirit of the novel? And if the answer is yes, I usually don't mind various character changes or plot changes or whatever, as long as that answer is yes. When the answer is no, I very much have a problem with it. And it often means to me that the people making the movie didn't quite get the book they were adopting. To return for a second to how this started off with a very straightforward screenplay, I do think one of McCarthy's kind of guiding stars throughout this novel is simply subverting the notions of how a genre work should work. We find out early on that Llewellyn is a sniper. So the first thing we see him do is miss a shot.
Yeah. And that's very tongue-in-cheek, too, because we get about a page of how good Llewellyn is as a sniper, how he understands the drop of the bullet and the, you know, everything about it. And yet he misses.
Our friend Wallace has written on how it may well be that he's, you know, the gun he's using seems underpowered for the distance he's trying to shoot. And so it was a bad decision from a hunting standpoint. It was much more likely to wound and to strand the animal. And so it was a bad decision in many other ways.
Well, Wallace, you know, you understand Wallace himself trained as a sniper in the Marines.
Right.
So he had a great insight into it. Wallace Sanborn Jr., by the way.
I should have clarified. About.
Yeah.
And we had him on to talk about McCarthy and animals. And so Llewellyn is, and of course, what does the sniper do? He holds up somewhere and waits for the perfect shot. Instead, Llewellyn immediately acts like prey. He takes off running. He's always on the run. He doesn't, in some way or another, try to find a place to hole up and let them come to him. And you probably remember the panel you and I were on at American Literature Association Symposium, Rick, where I compared this to the screenplay by Elmore Leonard, which was turned into a film in the 70s, Mr. Majestic, which is a Charles Bronson
movie,
right, about an Army veteran who runs afoul of organized crime and who lures him up into the mountains and kills a lot of them off. And how that novel and the screenplay, which precedes it and becomes a movie, they play to all your expectations, because that's part of what we want from formula writing, from genre writing. We have a certain expectation, and the contract between the author and the reader is that our expectations are fulfilled. And if you're going to be the kind of person who subverts those expectations, like a Hammett or a Raymond Chandler or other writers who move genre writing into the more literary realms, then you have to really earn the right to have it subvert those expectations, because people are not friendly to that kind of betrayal. So one of the things that's so valuable and interesting to me is we know when Ed Tom comes into it, we're supposed to see the two of them team up. And of course, it never happens. We're supposed to see Ed Tom Bell find his courage. It never happens. We're supposed to see Carla Jean win through. It never happens. And so the traying our expectations, subverting all these notions of how things are supposed to work, I think is a lot of what the book is about. And of course, that ties into the whole notion of the coin flip as well. And you may remember there are a number of years where people are looking at chaos theory a lot and applying it to this book, and how chaos theory and game theory, even before chaos theory, and how that would apply as well.
Well, I think the coin flip, or the principle of the coin flip, as Shiger outlines it, you know, twice, in fact, he discourses to the gas station clerk, and he discourses to Carla Jean just before he kills her about the, you know, about the coin flip. And that comes back in the form of the car accident, you know, and he gets T-boned by the stone teenagers.
Right.
That's a kind of the whole, his idea about the coin flip coming back to haunt him.
You know, Shiger is not the first villain to use a coin flip to decide things. The Batman villain Two-Face, who premieres during World War II in the early 40s, always uses a scarred two-headed coin to decide whether to do good or do bad. And it's hard for me to think that at any point McCarthy would have gotten the notion of coin flipping from Batman comics or the first cheesy iteration of that character in a film, which would have been the same one of Jim Carrey. And I guess it's Val Kilmer as Batman in that version. I hate to get all conspiracy based, but of course, Tommy Lee Jones played Two-Face as well as Sheriff Bell. So I don't know about that. But anyway, it's hard for me to think of McCarthy watching that movie and saying, oh, I could use that in a more interesting literary way. But it's also always been hard for me to read about Shiger and not think of the Batman comics I read as a kid. And a couple of times that Robin escapes death because the coin comes up good. Or the one time Batman slips him a weighted coin so that it comes up on edge and Two-Face freaks out and doesn't know what to do because Batman's pulled a little sleight of hand on him as he was wont to do in those days. So there's a lot of weird connections here. What about, as we look at Ed Tom Bell, when the book first came out, but before the film came out, which I think was 2009, so there's a 4-year lag there. There was a lot of people, and there's a Vanity Fair piece by the guy who wrote the very good earlier interview, I think Richard Woodward, that kind of want to say Ed Tom Bell is a somewhat autobiographical character from McCarthy, and all the kind of nostalgia you see in Bell and the way he looks back at the past and think things were so much better back then and all the other things he sees. They want to say that this is McCarthy's stand-in in the novel. Do you see that at all with Tom Bell?
No.
Yeah.
You know, that's just a form of the intentional fallacy, you know.
Yeah. It's an extreme form of the intentional fallacy, really, because it shows such a lack of research or understanding who the writer has been.
Yeah, and certainly a lack of understanding of McCarthy's work and the evolutions of his themes over the years. It wasn't just Woodward. It was also that Wood.
James Wood.
James Wood.
The New Yorker.
Yeah. Well, you know, I railed against that in my American Lit speech.
Right.
I thought that was just ridiculous. You know, Wood simply assumes that because Ed Tom has these very conservative social views that McCarthy does. And come on, man. James Wood has been writing criticism long enough to know better than that.
Right.
I found that just an amazingly superficial take on the novel and the character. You know, he said that McCarthy set Ed Tom Bell out as his culture warrior. And I think that what I said then was, it's funny, culture warrior, you know, he's guilt-ridden, he's cowardly, he shirks, you know, he shrinks from confronting.
Is he cowardly, though, Rick, or is he suspect himself of being cowardly?
Yeah, he suspects himself of being cowardly to the point that in effect, he might as well be.
It freezes him up some.
Yeah,
but, you know, that scene, I just recently reread the book for the first time in a number of years, and I was astounded how much the film had infected my reading of the book. Because in the film, you know, he finally kind of forces himself to go in that hotel room with the chance that Shiger is in there, and you had that scene of Shiger outside waiting for him, and he's scared to go into the dark room. And on rereading the book, he goes back, he gets in his car, and he radios for backup. And then they actually do go in and they look through the whole motel and they just miss Shiger because he got there too late in the first place. And from my point of view, that was the smart thing to do because I don't really like it when the cop knows he's up against some desperado who's Jesse James reborn and is an amazing shot. And he takes out his trusty 38 and says, I'm going in there by myself. I'm not waiting for backup.
Yeah.
Why? well, just because the plot wants me to do it, I'm going to do it. You know, I think there's a kind of self-pity that I think is going on in the book with Ed Tom, and that he realizes he's growing old and he's a little outdated, and that's part of what's going on here as well.
Yeah, it definitely is. And there's also that another hint to how he's softening up. And he just says, well, you know, my little daughter died, and I talk to her, you know, now and then. Talk to her. He's not the kind of hard-nosed guy. In fact, he goes to visit his, you know, Uncle Ellis.
Right.
You know, and Uncle Ellis has to stiffen his spine a little bit.
Which is, of course, a bad pun, given that he's had a spinal injury for many years and is wheelchair-bound because of the spinal injury.
Yeah.
Uncle Ellis, but he doesn't kind of sit around complaining. He refuses to do it. Well, and I think, so Ed Tom's interesting in other ways. This is our first significant use of the first person in McCarthy since Child of God.
Yeah.
And in the same way that Child of God is, it's never from Lester's point of view. It's simply these intercalary sessions before most of the chapters where we hear other people speak. And we go to their point of view for a minute as they talk about Lester. So we see how Lester, much in the way that character like Emily Grierson in Faulkner's great short story, A Rose for Emily, is judged by the entire town. And in that story, the whole story is told by a first person plural, we voice of the town. We thought this, we thought that. So in Child of God, we have that little intercalary first person sections of townspeople. And we see how they all judge him, and he's at the center of all things. So in this novel, on the other hand, there are these interceding chapter breaks, first person thinking back to World War II, thinking back to other things that have happened, thinking back to the killer he sends off to the gas chambers in Huntsville, Texas, and so on. And they give us a kind of inside view of Ed Tom Bell in a way we don't have it in other places.
Yeah.
And McCarthy's third-person points of view are usually not going in for deep introspection. And when they do, they often are very complex. It's usually what they perceive and feel about what they're perceiving. It's not going in and he thought and he thought and he thought.
Yeah, and a lot of times the most revealing thing about that.
Right.
Or what they're wrong about.
Right.
Or what we objectively discover they're wrong about.
Yeah, and then Ed Tom here does give us more of that insight. And so the stuff about him as a culture warrior, and I might argue, you know, McCarthy's culture warrior is Cornelius Sutry, you know. Let's look at how he reacts to his culture.
For Wood to say that about McCarthy and Ed Tom, considering the immense sympathy, I'll call it sympathy, that McCarthy has for outsiders and down-and-outers and the broken and the, you know.
Right. And really his greatest distaste always seems to be for the well-to-do people who sit in judgment of others more than anyone else seem to be the ones that he most often puts between the crosshairs.
Yeah. And if anybody, I think that McCarthy resembles, you know, Thomas Mann's struggling writer, Tonio Kreuger.
Ah.
You know, who concludes that story by saying, my sympathy will always be for the simple, for the,
right,
the blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, McCarthy's is for the opposite, you know,
yeah,
the detritus of society.
As we go through a little bit more with Ed Tom Bell, now I kind of want to bring us back to something else. I do think his being a veteran, he's thought of as a war hero, and he doesn't think he should be because he finally had a time when he could have come out of hiding and surprised a group of Germans that have overrun his position and gone down fighting and dying, or he lets them go past and then he slips away and gets away from them, and he's the only survivor of his position being overrun. He sees that as a failure. And of course, I think the reader very much says that's ridiculous that you think of yourself that way. And of course, his uncle, it's the kind of information his uncle gives him as well. And his uncle's the one who, when he says, are things so much worse now than they've ever been? And he says, no, remember what happened to your grandfather? I was shot off the porch. Remember what happened to all these other people, all these things that have happened. He makes him very aware that this kind of violence and disregard for orderliness. And it's been a constant tug of war between the forces of order and the forces of chaos since there have been people to represent one camp or the other or both.
Yeah.
And he really tears down the notion that Ed Tombell would be the culture hero from McCarthy's point of view immediately. It doesn't mean we can't be sympathetic to his point of view in places or can't like Ed Tombell. I like Ed Tombell's character. Oh, there's some weird elements to it, I think. One thing I want to ask you about, Rick, is we're talking about the throwback to Holden with Chigurh, and I think it is very clearly there. And one of the things he does with Holden, you and I talked about in an earlier podcast, he always leaves a door open that there is something supernatural going on with Holden. He never makes you,
yeah.
He never commits to it in the same way that Poe or Hawthorne, as Steve Fry always points out, those early Gothic romantic writers never completely make you aware if it's supernatural or just seems to be. Well, actually, sometimes Poe does just have it be supernatural. The dead do rise occasionally. But very often there's a maybe, maybe not element.
Well, there's that what we call the uncanny in the classic right. definition of the term.
Yeah.
You know, it can be, you know, or it might not be, but it could be, you know, yeah.
And Holden definitely occupies that space. With Chigurh, we don't necessarily see that. But on the other hand, the way he comes on as a one-man, you know, death wave, as they say it, a one-man demographic hit in your zip code to your insurance policy and all that, is not because he's such an incredible planner and he's some kind of Moriarty developing these really subtle schemes to take people off the board. It's more he's just impervious. He just simply walks down the street, and when the cartel guys show up while he's going after Llewellyn Moss, he just shoots those guys.
Yeah.
And then later, even though Llewellyn gets pretty close to hitting him and does hit him in the leg, but he doesn't kill him. He just kind of plans a way to still, you know, there's almost an imperviousness to harm. And you are given ample evidence that he is not invulnerable, the way his arm is so badly broken at the end or when Llewellyn shoots him in the leg. But he just simply seems not to care. And he's somehow armored by that lack of regard for himself in some way or another.
In that, he reminds me of that, what was his name? G. Gordon Liddy. And the famous candle.
Oh, yeah, putting his hand in the fire.
Put a hand in the fire and saying the trick isn't that it doesn't hurt. The trick is that you don't mind that it does.
Right.
Yeah, there's a relentlessness about Chigurh.
Yeah.
But, you know, Chigurh's vulnerability, you know, Llewellyn hits him at one point, right? And then there's a car accident, you know.
Right.
It's not that he's invulnerable. It's just that he doesn't mind.
Yeah.
You know, he just goes on. I mean, you see him blowing up the car to distract everybody at the pharmacy.
The drugstore.
So again, steal the drugs. And then you see him sitting in the bathtub, stitching up his own leg and watching television. He's a fascinating character. But again, all of that, that's all indicative of his psychosis.
Yeah.
You know,
do you think that leg scene where he's practicing bathtub medicine on himself, on his leg, is supposed to in any way or another remind us of John Grady cauterizing his bullet wound in All the Pretty Horses?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, I could see that. More than anything, I think it reminds me of what Wallace Sanborn wrote about him and it. Likelihood that he's had military training.
Mm.
You know, that's the kind of survival training that soldiers are taught.
Right. McCarthy is very cagey with his background. People presume he's got some kind of East European background at some point. And it's funny to hear people in websites talk about his Spanish or Mexican accent. And of course, that's 100% due to the film adaptation. None of that is in the book. They think he...
We get no indication of any patois or anything to the book. And McCarthy is so good at rendering patois right. that if he had one, we'd see it.
Right. There'd be some kind of phrase or statement that's a little bit out of place that you'd pounce on.
Yeah.
So there is that reference that Wells makes to knowing him from their military days or possibly doing work with the CIA that implies that there's a connection there as well, right?
Yeah. Well, they know each other as criminals.
Right.
Wells is interesting in that, you know, the inference is that his military training made him a criminal. But, Wells is no less a psychopath or sociopath than Sugar. He just tilted a little differently, you know.
I might disagree. I mean, I certainly, without lionizing or turning Wells into some kind of hero, I can't see him going to Carla Jean's house and killing her because the husband made him irritated that the husband didn't comply when he told him to comply. Him going that extra step for that reason?
No, I don't see him. But again, you know, there's a point in this conversation with Moss, who Moss says, "Yo, you're a hitman." And right. Wells just sort of, you know, bemusedly repeats hitman, you know, like, hey, no, I'm a highly trained military operative. You can't just call me a common hitman, you know, but that's what he is, you know.
Well, sure. Well, and it touches upon some of the places where we get a little weird with our public entertainment. So if we have a military guy who's incredibly well trained to kill people and he goes after, let's say, cartel thugs and cartel strongmen and cartel sicarios and assassins, and he's wiping those guys out, we don't typically think of that guy working for who we consider the good guys to be a hitman, although he is, like you say.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's who Wells was. I'm saying in general, we wouldn't think of him that way, although he is. And if he doesn't have at least some amount of amorality and some part of him that just has no problem with that, of course, those things, you know, couldn't occur. So that's a good point.
Well, you know, you talk about a parallel with All the Pretty Horses. I mean, with Blood Meridian. One of the things that makes the kid heroic is that McCarthy never shows us specifically the kid participating in the carnage that the Glanton gang,
right,
you know, undertakes. The same is true of Wells. We don't have any direct apprehension of all of the murders that Wells must have committed to having been to qualify him to have been hired by
exactly, the but his company. Resume had to get him in the door, and that resume has got to be pretty bloody in the first place.
Yeah. So Wells is a benign figure, and he even becomes sympathetic when Sugar blows his head off.
Right. And we do have a couple of interesting death sequences, and this reminds me of rereading the book. I was I was very surprised how much McCarthy, not necessarily McCarthy, but his characters are romanticizing marriage.
Yeah.
So Ed Tom Bell, every time someone references Loretta or marriage or anything, repeats to such a point that it's almost annoying in the book, she was the best thing that ever happened to him. And someone...
I never gave God a reason to smile on me, but he did.
Yeah, yep. And someone drives by and he's standing, you know, on the bridge looking down, and someone yells out, just poking at him, "She's not worth it, Sheriff." And he goes, "Oh, but she is."
Yeah.
His mind. And then, of course, we see a little bit of that with Llewellyn and Carla.
And you see it in John Grady, too.
Well, yeah, and it's a whole different thing with John Grady. John Grady never grows up enough to know better, but...
Yeah.
The relationship between Llewellyn Moss and Carla Jean, to me, feels kind of clumsy. And I tend to believe it when we see the scenes from Carla Jean's point of view and when she's talking to Ed Tom, more than I do when I see Llewellyn and Carla Jean together.
Yeah.
And there's a part of that which falls a little flat to
me. Well, Carla Jean defends Llewellyn to her mother.
Right. Well, and that part works, but when Llewellyn and Carla Jean are together, it doesn't quite work. There's just some weird stuff here. We look at the age difference between them, which is not so tremendous that it really is horrifying to us or anything, but it's enough that we notice it. It's enough. It was chosen in here for reasons I don't know if I quite understand. And in addition to that, we simply, again, the way he so romanticizes the notion of these women, I have a theory about it, but I don't know how, whether it would be really working. If this were a normal Western novel, I'd know exactly what I think it is. But
yeah, let's not forget also the way that at Mac in Cities of the Plain
right.
remembers Margaret, his wife.
Right. You know, Margaret, his wife.
You know, my wife was beautiful, but what you could see couldn't hold a candle to what was on the inside.
Right. Well, yeah. and everyone else who knew her validates that. So that's not simply his point of view, but the whole,
yeah.
all the ranch hands and the help as well all feel that way about her. You know, in classic Westerns and in the novels and in the films, the men are always out there first and always represent a kind of unbridled chaos. So if the frontier is going to be won, quote unquote, big, you know, winning the West, quote marks around that, with all the automatic modern suspicion about colonialization, how indigenous peoples are treated, all that aside for a second, it's going to be won. It's going to be done by people who don't fit well into civilized society. So then when the women folk come out, not simply prostitutes and so on, but actual wives and mothers and grandmothers, school teachers, Sunday school teachers, and so on.
Yeah, they're the ones who do the domesticating.
The ones domesticate everyone, and yeah. then the men have to act differently. And so you see this played out beautifully in the John Ford film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, yeah, where absolutely.
The Westerner Tom, rancher, who kind of represents a different earlier stage of development, can't quite let go of his violence and his rough-hewn ways, is in love with the woman, and Jimmy Stewart, who plays, oh, I can't remember his name now, but is the man who is a law school graduate and coming out to practice law and eventually becomes kind of mayor of the town and eventually a senator for the new territory, or a delegate for the new territory and eventually a senator. And he represents a new way of doing things in domesticated space. And so you almost wonder if Ed Tom, and for that matter, Llewellyn, romanticizing their matrimony and their wives, is they're embracing this domesticization and moving away from violence and darkness and evil, because the women always represent a safe space where those things go away. And you do see that played out with how much the prisoners love Loretta and how she takes them all in as lost children, in a way, bringing them out in the house and feeding them and all those kind of, and so much so that Ed Tom's personally losing money into,
which I hate to say, it reminds me of Aunt B in the Andy Griffith Show.
Well, there you go. Well, can we have any discussion of a rural sheriff and not have Andy Taylor be part of it?
No,
I think this is our first time bringing in the Andy Griffith Show on the podcast, so I appreciate that. I don't know if it's the first Batman. So well, we have Godzilla and Andy Taylor. All today is a series of firsts there for you, Rick.
Well, if you recall, Aunt B, you know, was kind of a mother to the prisoners, but they dreaded her because they made
she made them
mop the floors and clean.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
they called the house where Aunt B lived the Rock.
Well, the Rock.
Yeah. So anyway, but that was sort of domestication with a vengeance, you know.
Right. So maybe that's what some of this, the way that he makes Loretta out to be the saint among women. And of course, the sad thing about Carla Jean is she never gets old enough to have her own life, because she threw in with Llewellyn. And who, if we're going to define Llewellyn, I mean, what would be your characteristics of him? Would it be arrogance or hubris?
Hubris, definitely.
Bad luck?
You know, he simply says, well, everything's going to be great.
Right.
We got the money and things are going to be fine. You go to your mom's, I'll take care of everything else, you know.
They won't think to look for you there. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you know, first thing that Sugar does when he breaks into the trailer is he reads the phone bills.
Right.
Which is a classic move. And Carla Jean is very hard-headed, very stubborn. She's more that way in the film, I guess, even than in the novel.
Well, she's allowed to fight a little more. I mean, there's no physical fighting, but just simply
a
philosophical argument with Sugar in that last sequence. She has a little more to say than she does in the novel. And she's not quite so willing to roll over for Llewellyn earlier. So, yeah, she's got a little more she's a little more stand up in the film than she is in the novel.
Yeah.
I think part of that can be argued with simply that she's so young. He's much older than her. He's in his 30s. She's what, 19 or something, or 18?
Yeah, 19, 20, yeah.
Yeah, so
I also love the secretary at the trailer park in the film.
Well, she's great.
Says that, do you not understand? We can't give you that information.
Yeah, she too is another implacable force of nature.
Yeah,
much
yeah.
like Holden and Chigurh are, and she stands against them.
And Borden pulled that off beautifully, the way he looks at her.
Yeah,
you know, like he can't believe
how dare she not understand the danger she's in, and she almost perhaps does, and simply doesn't care.
Yeah,
that is her. And then
he looks very quickly out the window to see if anyone's out there. And they just decide it's not worth it, you know.
But you know what you've just illustrated, Rick, is that neither of us are capable of completely divorcing our understanding of this book from that movie. The movie is so well realized.
Yeah.
It's a lot like To Kill a Mockingbird, the Harper Lee novel versus the Gregory Peck film.
Yeah.
And you cannot read. I defy most people who've seen the film more than once to read that novel and not envision Gregory Peck and the other characters as well, but particularly Peck in the role of Atticus Finch.
Yeah, well, then again, of course, the very long-awaited follow-up, The Set of Watchmen, really undermines the Atticus Finch.
Well,
Peck Atticus Finch.
Yeah, except it's a prequel that she couldn't get published and should have thrown away, and her new executor of the literary estate decided, it was something she had written all along. So it's actually written before she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and she never threw it away. And the editor at the time said, this is not particularly good, but it seems that the kids are great. That's what you want to focus on. She went back and wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and it's much better. And she does turn Atticus from a more problematical character in her first version, one that's probably truer to who her father was in real life, to a more heroic character in To Kill Mockingbird. Yeah. So that's an interesting change. Well, we have that ending car wreck with Chigurh. So all through the book, we've heard about the coin flipping. We've heard about there are certain ways or certain rules. This coin traveled to be here with you. And the whole notion that he seems to have is he is the right hand of fate. And when fate makes a decree, Chigurh is there to act upon it. And it's not his volition. It is the way the rules are, the way the rules are. And they could be spared by the coin flip, if possible. So what about he's been fairly careful. He's been paying attention to things. There are some who read the fact that he is prey to getting hit in the car, that he doesn't see the other one coming at the end because he's a little bit rattled by Carla Jean. I don't know if I read it that way necessarily as closely. Maybe there is a little line in there that could lead that way. But is there a part of you, Rick, that sees this as the universe telling him you've gone outside the rules, you've overstepped your bounds at all with that catastrophic, arm injury to him?
No, I don't think so, because of the once again, very systematic and cool-headed way he goes about dealing with it.
Yeah, he gets out of it pretty well.
He buys the shirt. Here's $100 for the shirt. He makes a sling out of it. He walks away. And, you figure it, at worst, this is going to be a repeat of the stitching up the leg scene. You know, he'll go and deal with it. But you also know that once he does deal with it and once it heals up, he is going to go back to the cartel and take it over and kill everybody who's currently in charge. It's the universe reminding him that he's not invulnerable.
Yeah.
But then I go back to what he says to Wells, if the rule that you followed brought you to this, then what good was the rule? In his way, he'll probably learn from it.
In the book, one of the later there is a chapter after that where Bell speaks to the boy who at first lies to them, and eventually between he and his friend, the other sheriff, initially just indirectly talking to the boy, and then later when he runs into him again at the diner, he more or less know that they're being lied to, and they slowly get out what they could from him.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes you think at first that Ed Tom has not given up the search, but then he does. And of course he goes and sees his uncle, and we get the great quote about his father going into the darkness and lighting a path for him. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, he's not going to go after him. He's going to quit.
Right.
And, you know, he tells us very early on, he says, I walked in front of those eyes again, and I won't do it again. Right. I mean, I walked in front of those eyes once, I won't do it again, because a man would have to put his soul at hazard.
Right.
Ed Tom is the one who romanticizes Chigger.
Yeah.
You know, a true and living prophet of destruction. That's Ed Tom creating a monster sufficiently impregnable to justify his refusal to deal with it.
That's a really interesting point. The other thing that just struck me, I was thinking back on what you said earlier about how John Grady, of course, always romanticizes women, you know, or girls, Alejandra and Magdalena. In some ways, you could almost argue John Grady's whole Achilles heel is his inability to completely live in the reality he's in. And he's always got this Quixote-esque romantic view of the world around him and really thinks that courage and good intentions will get him through. And they don't. Whereas Ed Tom has a couple of times let the courage slide and done the pragmatic thing and feels all this guilt for it. And it almost seems to be like Ed Tom's the guy who learned the lesson that John Grady wouldn't learn. But the other side of it is there's always this disappointment in himself.
Yeah.
Of course, John Grady doesn't have to live with that. John Grady follows through.
Yeah. But of course, Ed Tom does have Loretta.
Right.
You know, and she stabilizes his life. So
right.
John Grady never really does find that. Alejandra says, "Nope, Daddy didn't want me to see you anymore, so I'm not going to see you anymore."
Right.
And pretty much abandons him.
Right. Well, and you get the feeling it was never quite as important to Alejandra as it was to John Grady, that it was with her a little bit more of a, you guys have tried to force me into this box. You can't force me to be what I don't want to be. I'll do whatever I want. Oh, look, here's a good-looking American boy.
Yeah.
Whereas for John Grady, oh, she's the love of my life. I'll never be the same afterwards. And then in a couple of years, rinse and repeat.
Well, there's also, you know, in The Crossing, there's that scene where Billy sees the actress bathing in the river.
Right.
And he says, well, my life will never be the same again. But the next, you turn the page and nothing's changed, really.
Right. Well, and the young girl in The Crossing, Billy's the one who has a shotgun and swings her up behind him and does most of the physical stuff to save her from the men that are clearly going to do her great harm. And yet she falls in love with, or she falls for Boyd,
yeah,
not Billy. Yeah. And Billy seems to be the one who's destined to be the buddy or the brother and always permanently in the friend zone, rather than in the romantic interest zone there in both books, as far as we can see, and that he's in. Well, as we move toward the end and thinking about this novel, where would you put it now in your personal estimation of all of, you know, I used to always end these shows with what's your favorite one? And I heard you on that. And I was even surprised to find that after Blood Meridian, this one might be second among favorites, but in terms of essential McCarthy works, where do you place this among McCarthy's overall body of works?
Okay, in the sense of its canonicity.
Yeah, I'll say in importance.
I'd put it much further down than I do in terms of my own personal favorite. You know, I'd say that it's probably down in the last third.
Okay, but as a personal favorite, is it number two? Does it come in second?
Yeah, it's still number two.
That's great.
It's the one I'll pick up and just, you know, happily reread just for favorite moments and passages. After Blood Meridian, which is still number one,
right,
solidly ensconced there. And Sutri comes in number three now. Well, it used to come in number two.
Right.
I got to tell you a great story about Sutri and why the watermelon scene you know, dominates that. When I first got my hands on Sutri, it was a beat up old remaindered copy from, I found Greenwich Village in a book bin. I was reading it for the first time. I don't remember where I was going. I think I was going from New York back to Miami. I was reading it in the Admiral's Club, the American Airlines Admiral's Club. And sitting elsewhere in the club, not too far away from me, were the three members of the New York Mets broadcasting team, Ralph Kiner and Lindsey Nelson and Tim McCarver. And Tim McCarver, incidentally, was a great Civil War aficionado, by the way.
Ah, okay.
Great admirer of Shelby Foote and what have you. So I'm sitting there and I'm reading and I hit the watermelon scene and I burst out in uncontrollable hysterics. You know, I was laughing so hard that I got other people in the club there contagiously laughing, including Tim McCarver. And he comes over to me and he says, "What are you reading that did that to you?" And I showed him Vince Suttree. And he said, "Oh yeah, Corbach McCarthy, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I've never read that one. Is that good?" And I said, "Hey, you know, you heard me, you know." So it's my little anecdote about the watermelon scene. The secretary at the Admiral's Club there was coming over to me with a pencil in her hand. I think she thought I was having an epileptic seizure.
Well, what's she going to do with that pencil? Stab you with it or have you bite it? Or
have me bite it, yeah. Okay. Keep me from swallowing my tongue. But McCarver was very impressed by that.
It'd be great to know if he ever read it and if he owes you some help for turning him on to one of the funniest books in all of literature.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the funniest characters in all of literature.
Yeah.
As well. Well, and I think one of the things I'm going to introduce on the show right now, and I've been thinking about this for a while, is who is your favorite character in all of McCarthy?
Judge Holden.
Judge Holden. Holden. Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to say, but I thought Harrogate might make a play.
Harrogate comes in number two. Yeah.
Number two. I was thinking he might be the person, if you drew a pie chart or a graph of who's diametrically the opposite of Chigurh, it might be Gene Harrogate would be the exact opposite.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But somehow still floating along with the winds of chance at his back and just feckless and thinking, you know, oh, it's all going to work out okay somehow. He gets all those bats and he takes them up to the doctor and he thinks he's going to get $2 a head. And he doesn't, but he still gets $2 and he's not dismayed. Still got $2. So,
by the way, I'll tell you that the Uncle Ellis of the movie ranks there too because of one line he says to Ed Tom. He says, "I make a fresh pot of coffee every week, whether there's any left or not." that has always stayed with me.
Actor's name is Barry Corbin, and yeah, he just absolutely nails it. And Coen Brothers are always great, and I always love it when they would bring back their original cast of characters over and over again. I'm a little disappointed that they're making movies separately now. I haven't felt that separated, that Ethan and Joel are as good as the sum of their parts were, but maybe that'll change as
well. They may circle back to each other, but I wish the hell they do Suttree. I really do.
It'd be great to see if anyone could pull it off. It'd be those two guys.
It'd be them. I don't think anybody else could do it.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, thanks again to today's guest, Rick Wallach. Rick is the founder of the Cormac McCarthy Society, a senior and primary editor of the Cormac McCarthy Society Casebook Series, and editor of the two-volume collection of essays, Sacred Violence, as well as Myth, Legend, Dust, Critical Responses to Cormac McCarthy, and co-editor to Linnea Chapman King and the late James Welsh of From Novel to Film, No Country for Old Men. He's currently working on a new book called In Search of Godzilla, Myth, History, and Politics in Ishiro Honda's Masterpiece. Thanks again, Rick.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Thomas Fry, as always, who composed, performed, produced, and music for Reading McCarthy. The views of the host and his guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their home institutions or the Cormac McCarthy Society, although in our hearts we hope they'll someday see the light. We appreciate favorable reviews on your favorite podcasting platform. If you enjoy this podcast, you may also enjoy the Great American Novel podcast, hosted by myself, Kurt Kerna. To contact me, please reach out to readingmccarthy@gmail.com. Despite the evening redness in the West, Reading McCarthy is also still nominally on Twitter or X or Twix, whatever we call it. The website's at readingmccarthy.buzzsprout.com. If you'd like to support the show, you can click on the little heart symbol at the top of the webpage to buy the show a cappuccino. Thanks again, everyone.